Hello, Marion. It's Dan. I'm going to try to answer your questions here in this audio file. You may hear from time to time some background sounds. It's just my dog playing. So the first question you asked is, can you give me some stories of individuals you have taught, both in-house and via Zoom? I don't really have any stories to tell you about via Zoom, and especially in the corporate setting, there's really no interactions that will allow me to tell you about how the classes have affected people. In the future, that might change. And in terms of the stories of people that I've taught in-house, I could definitely tell you stories, but the stories would be more related to the Compassion Center, where I was teaching individuals and groups outside of the corporate environment. But still, I'll share at least one of them with you right now. And you should not tell the story exactly as is, because it really doesn't have, as it's being told, a clear application to the corporate environment. But I will give you license to edit the story so that it makes it, so you can make it appeal to any person with an HR that might be reading this and considering the value of mindfulness and meditation. So this has to do with a gentleman named Joe. That's his real name. Joe was a gentleman who was probably about, I would say when Joe came to me, maybe about 60, somewhere between 60 and 65. Bus driver for many years, and had some severe back problems. One evening, we were scheduled to do group meditation. It was a snow evening, and no one had shown up for the class, not to be surprised. And right about 5 minutes before the class was about to start, I got a call from Joe, who says, "Dan, are you doing the class?" And I said, "Well, I wasn't planning on, because no one showed up." He says, "Oh, that's too bad, because I'm right outside." I said, "Well, Joe, if you're right outside, then you've got to come in. So come on in." So Joe came in, and I ended up doing a class just for Joe. When we started the class, I noticed that Joe was sitting in a slightly slumped over position. And Joe knew how to properly sit for meditation with his back in an upright posture. So I asked Joe, "Joe, why are you bending forward like that?" And he says, "Oh, Dan," he says, my back is killing me. He says, "I'm in a lot of pain right now." I said, "Oh, it's terrible, Joe." I said, "What happened?" And Joe had some spinal issues, and he went to his doctor for regular treatments. So I said to Joe, "Well, Joe, let's try something, see if I can help you out. I do mantra work, and please be very careful about how you explain this within any article or any references, because you should not mention mantra. Mantra is a major turnoff to corporations. So you could just say the guide, you can reference this as a guided meditation. But for your own sake, I will explain this." So I did a particular mantra called the Green Tara Mantra. And in Green Tara Mantra, you imagine this deity, Green Tara, and you imagine her coming to you in your time of need and helping you with whatever difficulties you're having. So we did the Green Tara Mantra, and at the end of the meditation, I asked Joe, I said, "So how are you feeling?" And Joe's response was, "I'll get back to you." I was like, "Oh, you'll get back to me. Okay, I don't know what that means. I don't know if his experience was good or bad." So probably about a couple months later, I asked Joe for a favor. As Joe drove buses, I needed a small van to drive some stuff out to New Jersey. So Joe helped me drive out to Jersey. Then on the way back, he says to me, "Dan, you remember that question you asked me the other day at the end of the Green Tara Mantra?" I said, "Sure." He says, "Well, I'm going to answer that now." So, wonderful. So he says to me, "You know, when I came to you," he says, "I was in considerable pain." I said, "Yes, I remember that." And he says, I hadn't been to see my doctor for a while, and I was due to go see him the following day. But he says, at that moment, he says he was in a lot of pain, and there was nothing he could do to help himself. So he says, after the mantra, he was quite surprised to notice that the pain had almost completely disappeared. Not just after, and this was a late night class, this was an 8 to 9 p.m. class, not just that evening, but the following day, he went to the doctor. When he woke up, he said he felt great. He said, didn't feel any pain. Went to his doctor, and his doctor examined him, and he said, Joe, are you experiencing any pain? He says, no, not at all. The doctor made a joke out of it. He said, okay, Joe, are you going to see another doctor now? And just, no, I'm not seeing another doctor. So he says, are you taking any medicine for this? Are you doing anything? He says, well, I'm not taking any medicine, but he says, I did this thing called a mantra. I said, really? He says, so, well, normally Joe would get a cortisone shot in his back. Very painful thing to get. He says, Joe, do you want a shot? And he says, no. He says, I'm good. I feel very good. He says, are you sure? He says, yeah, very sure. Joe went on to tell me, he says, that not only did the pain just about completely remove from his body, but he said he stayed that way for probably almost 3 weeks without the slightest bit of pain. So, great story to show the power of a meditation, how it can affect us. Now, did the mantra magically remove the pain? No, I don't think so. I'm a very spiritual guy, and I believe in the power of mantra and the stuff that we do. But I suspect what had happened was that he had gotten to a point where he was tightening up his body and tightening it up to the point that he was creating even greater pain. Sorry, I had to pause for a second. I believe what had happened was that the mantra, which is a repetition of one or more words for a period of time. When we say mantras, I use mala beads, which have 108 beads in them. So the words are repeated at least 108 times. In Joe's case, I think I did it at least two, if not three times. So it was 216 or 324 times. When we say the mantra, we repeat the word, it invokes a very quiet, very peaceful state, a very focused state. I think that what Joe experienced was that his mind was pulled away from the pain that was within his body, and it gave his body a chance to simply relax, to loosen, to untighten all that tightness that was in his back. I believe that that's what ultimately happened. So that's one story. I can tell you, generally speaking, I've had some wonderful experiences I'll tell you one other story. A woman named Pat, who came to me for a private meditation lesson a few years back. Pat came to me at a time where she had a stage 4 cervical cancer diagnosis. So pretty much death wish. I'm sorry to put it so harshly, but this is what it is. Not only was she in a stage 4 cancer situation, but her husband had also told her recently that a husband of many years that he was leaving her. So she came to me in really, really bad shape. Taught her how to meditate, talk with her, spent a lot of time talking with her, and recommended that she come to the classes. The cervical cancer had metastasized to other parts of her body, And one of the effects of it was that her lungs were starting to fill with fluid. I think they call this ascites or ascites. You could hear it because I did some breathing exercises with her, and she found it very difficult to pull in much air, very difficult to release much air. When she came to the group meditation classes, and she used to sit in the back of the class, when we would do the breathing exercises, not only was it very difficult for her to breathe in and breathe out, but she would typically cough. Not typically, she coughed every single class that we did it, but people were very understanding. I probably even said something to the group at one point to be patient with her. Something pretty amazing happened. It was about 2 months in, 2 or 3 months in to the group classes. I notice, I'm very aware of what goes on in the people that are in front of me. I notice that in one of the meditation classes, Pat did not cough. It was the only class that she had done in the group where she did not cough. And I even pointed that out to her. I said, Pat, did you notice at the end of the meditation, you didn't cough? And she didn't. But she says, look, I've got to tell you something. She said she went to see her oncologist. She just got her most recent labs back. And the doctor said that her stage 4 cancer was in remission. She hadn't completely beat it, but it was in remission. The fluid in her lungs had removed, and she was showing very positive signs of a full recovery. Ultimately, she did fully recover. She beat the cancer. And she became a committed meditator, came every single class, and she's one of several truly wonderful stories. There have been a good number of other stories of people who have greatly benefited from the meditation. People who had extreme anxiety who had come to me, and they were able to get their panic attacks beaten, completely under control. There are people that came in with debilitating physical issues that were able to get their symptoms under control. So there's a few stories for you. So I'm going to move on to the next questions. Do you have personal examples of health benefits? Okay, well, I've just explained that. I think I have, at least. Number 3, do you use a feedback form from which quotes can be taken, including permission to use their name? No, we don't have permission to use. There was only one time I used a survey with a program, and we don't have permission to use it outside of what it was used for the corporation. Can you tell a bit of your story with meditation? How did you get into it? What does it mean for your life? What is your motivation? Okay, so I was introduced to meditation. Now it's 54 years ago. I took my very first, I'm 61 years old in December. I did my very first meditation when I was 7 years old. And I did it because I was asked to come to a yoga class. I was in a summer camp. The one of the leaders of my bunk came up to me and pleaded with me one day. He says, Dan, he says, would you please come to my yoga class in the morning? And I'm 7 years old. I said, no, I don't do yoga. And he pleaded with me. And he says, look, I've asked everyone else. He says, none of the guys here. It was an all boys bunk. Not an all boys summer camp, but it was an all boys bunk. He says, none of the other guys will come. He says, you're my last hope. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't do meditation. I don't do yoga. He says, but if you don't come, I won't have any of the guys from here representing us in the class. I said, I don't understand. He says, yeah. He says, this is a class that's booked full of women. I said, really? All women, no guys? Even at 7 years old, I was like, okay, I like those odds. So I went, did my first yoga class, did my first meditation at the end. They did yoga nidra, where you lay down and what they call corpse pose. And the teacher guides you. And that was my first experience with meditation. I've practiced meditation and yoga on and off since then. But my biggest change in terms of my meditation practice came now a little more than a decade ago. It's about 11 years ago at this point, in which I was looking to get back into meditation. And it was good timing because, and please be careful with how you use this, because once again, in the corporate environment, you have to be very selective how you use this. My story actually does appear in the Compassion Center, but I'm reluctant for this full story to be told within Meditation House. So let's use some discretion here. Almost 11 years ago now, I decided to make a major lifestyle change. I had been a lifelong alcohol drinker. I've called myself for less than a handful of times, less than five times, I referred to myself as an alcoholic. Was I an alcoholic? I guess it would depend upon who you ask and what their definition is. I've met many alcoholics in my life. I've talked with many people who have alcohol relatives. I've seen the famous show on TV, Intervention, where they always do shows with alcoholics. And my drinking was nothing compared to any of these people. But did I drink almost every day? Yes. Did I drink to excess? Oh, I was a power drinker. From 6 p.m. on, I could drink and drink a lot. The thing that happened with me was I was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes approximately, now it's been a little more than 15 years ago, and I was told at the time when it was confirmed that I had to stop drinking. Well, I didn't stop drinking, and my drinking actually at one point actually increased. About 11 years ago, I woke up one morning, my body felt absolutely horrible. I felt like my liver was used as a punching bag. I felt it wasn't a normal hangover. I felt as bad as it gets. I just physically felt horrible. And I had to ask myself a very serious question, a very honest question. I had to ask myself, what was I doing? And I asked myself the question of, was I trying to kill myself by using alcohol? And the honest admission, it was, yes, I was. I was in a very depressed state for many years, on and off, carrying around a lot of emotional problems, and decided that I asked myself, well, if you want to kill yourself, there's a lot faster way to do it than taking this long, hard road. So I said, do you really want to kill yourself? And the answer was no. So I said, okay, well, if you don't want to kill yourself, then you got to knock this off. So I made that decision that morning when I woke up to stop drinking. And I've been sober now for 10 and a half years and have not had a single drink in 10 and a half years. I just stopped. I didn't go to any programs. I didn't go to Alcoholics Anonymous. I just decided to stop. I put my mind to it and decided to change my life. Not too long after I made that decision, I decided to return to my meditation practice. And for me, I had been so distant from my meditation practice, I felt the need to be with a teacher, to find a teacher and find a group. So I called around. I actually attended one of the classes in Manhattan with the famous Sri Chimnoy. Sri Chimnoy, who's a spiritual leader who has a pretty large organization. I went to their class. It wasn't bad what they were doing, but it kind of smacked a little bit of cult. I saw a little cult thing going on there. So I said, nah, I don't think I want to be involved with these guys. So I ended up, I was living in Staten Island at the time, and there was a museum, a Tibetan museum. It was the Jacques Marché Museum of Tibetan Art. And I called them because I had visited them the previous I guess, summer or spring. Beautiful setting up there. And I asked the person who answered the phone, I said, can you refer me to any place that offers meditation classes? Do you know of any? And they said, well, we just happen to offer meditation classes here. I said, that's wonderful. They said, yeah, it's offered every Saturday. And they're led by an ordained Tibetan Buddhist monk. So I said, oh, that sounds fascinating. So I said, great, let me come and check it out. So I went to the class and sat there with this relatively small group of people. And I tried to envision what this Tibetan Buddhist monk would look like. And I imagine a shorter man, shorter in stature, wearing red robe, bald head, looking very holy. And this person walks in, yep, shorter stature, wearing red robe, bald head, very spiritual looking, spiritual presence, sits down in front of us, and he turned out to be black, which really blew my mind. I thought it was the coolest thing. I said, how does a black man turn into a Tibetan Buddhist monk? And it turns out this was someone who was born in the USA of Haitian descent. He lived for years in Haiti and then ultimately settled in Brooklyn with his family. And he felt that there was a calling in his life to Buddhism and took his vows, became an ordained Tibetan Buddhist monk in the Gelug, G-E-L-U-G school. The Gelug is it is one of five different schools of the Mahayana Tibetan Buddhism schools. The Gelug school is also the school that the Dalai Lama is part of. Just as an aside, these days I go to the KTD Monastery in Woodstock, and this is run by, it's not Gelug, it's Karma Kagyu, and they have a different leader called the Karmapa. And that can be a conversation for some other time. But just a little bit of reference there. So this Tibetan Buddhist monk taught the class. I sat through the first class. It was very different from what I had experienced before. And just different, simply different. It wasn't different in a bad way. It wasn't different necessarily in a good way. It was just different. And ultimately, I thought that there was something in it that was interesting. So I didn't pass judgment on it. I just said, fine, I experienced it. Let me come back and see what it was all about. Came back the following week, sat through the class. One of the brilliant things that this particular teacher, his name was Thupten Puntsak, what he did was he would do approximately a 15 to 20 minute meditation, talk for 15 to 20 minutes, and then do another 15 to 20 minute meditation. In between the first and the second meditation, he opened up the room to questions, and I said, I did have questions. I asked him about the experience, what we were supposed to experience. I asked him about my experience. I noticed a small white light. It was like the size of a nickel, approximately, that appeared to me. And I asked him if that was normal or a common occurrence. He said it was a very common occurrence. Doesn't happen with everyone. He says it's a very strong visual. It's a great focal point. So I said, okay, well, it appears that I'm doing this correctly. And I said, all right, let's keep on going. And I continued going for those weeks after that. Ultimately, I befriended the monk. He took me under his wing. He trained me. I became a regular student of his. We became partners in the opening of the Compassion Center, with him being at the time the lead teacher. And we trained additional people beyond that. So I fully immersed myself in his training and in his style of teaching. And I've utilized his style of teaching, and I've changed it. I've made it more westernized. I made it more approachable, more understandable for the average person. The method that he taught me was based upon three different styles of meditation. Not necessarily in this order, but the three styles are mindfulness. Second style is, as he pronounced it, is vipassana. Now, people in the West typically say vipassana, but he assured me, he says it's pronounced vipassana. And I listened to the Dalai Lama talk, and he says it the same way. And I, from what I've understood, that many Indians say it also that way, which is where it comes from. So it was mindfulness, vipassana, as well as traditional Tibetan Buddhist meditation techniques. It's still a completely non-religious form of meditation. And when I teach it, I focus on the mindfulness aspect. I ultimately introduce the vipassana element. And I tried to talk with people about the Tibetan Buddhist meditation component, which is setting a motivation or an intention. And we can talk about that some other time if you wish. So here it was. I learned this new style of meditation. I embraced it. It supported my recovery process. Ultimately, the greatest thing that it did for me was that it opened up my mind to understand the reason why I used to drink and the reason why I was doing all this damage to myself. I had been to enough therapists to understand that the reason why I was drinking was because I was in a great deal of emotional pain that was inflicted upon me by my parents and my brother. And I was never able to make peace with these things, even through multiple therapists. And meditation gave me the tool to allow me to once and for all to make peace with these feelings. I used what is called the forgiveness meditation, where I learned to ask for forgiveness for all the damage I've done to others. And when, you know, it's part of the 12 steps in alcohol recovery, it's one of the most important steps is that you ask for forgiveness. You make amends with those that you've hurt. So I did that. I asked and gave forgiveness to myself for all the harm that I caused myself. And last, but certainly not least, and the most difficult hurdle of it all, was I learned to give forgiveness to my parents and to my brother. This was all, the changes that took place were truly profound, truly dramatic. I did a forgiveness meditation for almost 4 months straight, and I found that I was finally at peace with all these difficult emotional feelings that I've had for all those years. This practice has radically changed my life in that I was able to remove all that pain and suffering that was within my mind. I was able to start to like and ultimately love myself, something I wasn't able to do. My interactions with people dramatically changed. I became a much kinder, much more understanding, much more compassionate person. My health has continued to improve over the years. And in fact, I just did something. I've been on a blood pressure medicine for probably the last 20, maybe even 25 years. I literally just took myself off of this, and I've been off now for about a week and a half. And my blood pressure is normal now. I thought the timing was right, and sure enough, it was right. So do I attribute that to meditation? Absolutely. One of these days, I'll do a live test to show people that when you meditate, especially being a diabetic, type 2 diabetic, and also having hypertension, or at least so I did, was when I want to do this test where I take my numbers, my blood pressure and my glucose reading before I start to meditate, and then show people the numbers after. Meditation lowers your blood pressure. Meditation lowers your glucose number. It has proven physical benefits. Forget about the studies, all the studies that support it. I'm living proof that it works. It can bring a dramatic change to you. Okay, so let's move on. And what does it mean to your life? And what is your motivation? I didn't answer those things. What does it mean to my life? Meditation is an integral part of my life. It is something that for many years I did first thing when I woke up, as well as doing it once or twice during the day. These days I typically do meditation once, which is at about 8:30 in the evening. I always do a lot of reading, spiritual based readings to support it. It is such an integral part of my life that it is no different from the things that you and everyone else does on a regular basis. As we wake up and we know we should be brushing our teeth, washing our bodies, and getting the day started, well, that's how I see meditation. It is just as important as all those things. I don't have to force myself to go meditate, even though there are days that I find it difficult because I'm very tired. And so maybe those times I do push myself, but the result is always the same. I feel so much better after I do it. When I'm sick, I sit to meditate, and I can make myself physically feel so much better. I've sat with a flu in front of a class, a distance, of course, having to teach, and the symptoms were typical flu symptoms. At the end of the class, you would not have known that I had the flu. The meditation is that powerful in how it affects me and others. Meditation means, what does it mean for your life? It means that I have a tool that will sustain me for the rest of my life. I have a tool that no matter what happens in my life, no matter how difficult things become, if I become terminally ill, when someone passes that is close to me, my mind is prepared to deal with these things. It doesn't mean that I do not feel the emotions. It simply means I am able to control my emotions, that I am able to be at peace with my emotions. I don't have to go through these tremendous extremes of emotions that the average person goes through. What is your motivation? Oh, it's very simple. I am on a path right now. The ultimate goal for me right now. Well, the goal for me for right now is to become what is called a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva is someone who has dedicated his life to end the suffering of people. And this is something I've done since learning this practice, is that I have committed my life to helping each and every person to be free of their suffering. The bodhisattva vows, which I hope to take as soon as the monastery can reopen, they've been closed since the beginning of the pandemic, it will make a formal commitment to further helping people. It's a stronger commitment. It means much more time dedicated to it, which I already spend a decent amount of time, but it means even more time. You know, we've heard the stories about priests and nuns. I'm trying to think of the famous sister, the nun that passed away years ago, who was so famous from Rome. I'm sure the name is coming to you right now. I just can't think of her name for some reason right now. But these are the people that will sacrifice sleep. They will sacrifice food, sacrifice pleasure to help others. And this is ultimately where I'm heading towards. Will I ever become an ordained monk? I don't know. I don't know that. It is possible and may come later on in my life. I can't do it at this point simply because my vows would prohibit me from making money. As an ordained Tibetan Buddhist monk, you cannot make money. You cannot have sexual relations with a woman. These are two things I can't give up at this moment in my life. But as I get older, that may change. I may ultimately take the vows to become a yogi, which is, I am allowed to do certain things, but they are much stronger vows, so that's a possibility. Okay, when did you decide to do corporate mindfulness programs? I decided to do that in the very beginning of 2016. Meditation House and the Compassion Center came into existence at the end of 2015. The corporate, the goal was always with my partner Punsak, was to bring meditation into the corporate environment to help corporations. So that thought existed at the, right from the very beginning. And as I think I may have expressed you already, and if I haven't, I will express it here. And if I have, please forgive me for repeating myself. I believe that corporations, that meditation and mindfulness should be taught within corporations. It should be offered by corporations. The reason why I say that is because the realization is when I've taught classes to individuals and to groups, I used to teach an 8 to 9 p.m. class. If you think about it, you work a long day. You've got to go travel to sit with a teacher and take a class. You have to be extremely dedicated to do that. And I had extremely dedicated people that were willing to do that. But the reality is that the average person does not have that dedication. They need to make time during the day to meditate. Corporations need to wake up and understand that meditation, mindfulness, is not a luxury. It's an absolute essential. If you want to keep your employees healthy, by keeping them healthy, you reduce sick time. You also keeping them, you need to keep them happy. You want them to look forward to working and doing their jobs. You want them to be focused. It is in a corporation's best interests to offer mindfulness meditation programs. What does well-being mean to you? That's a great question. I'm not sure I can answer that right now because I'm running short on my time. So I would have to give some thought to that. Very quickly, what comes to mind? Well-being. Well-being is fully encompassing a physical and mental state, a positive, healthy state in both body and mind. We can have healthy bodies, but unhealthy minds. We can have healthy minds, but unhealthy bodies. It is a combination of the two. Mindfulness, meditation, helps keep both the body and the mind healthy. A well-being program should ultimately consist of not just meditation, but also yoga and or some type of exercise. It also should include proper diet. These are all important things. What does mindfulness mean for you? So mindfulness is, my understanding of mindfulness is evolving, especially now that I'm getting more involved with the mindfulness people in the USA and taking a program right now specifically on mindfulness training. I had been reluctant to embrace mindfulness because I felt it was only one aspect of what I was trained to teach. But I'm looking at it in a very different way now. Mindfulness, at least on the surface, applies to bringing the mind into a current state, to be fully aware of everything that we're doing at any given moment, not to drift off with our thoughts, but to feel our bodies, notice our minds in every moment. When someone talks to us, being fully aware of everything that they're saying and not drifting off with our thoughts. When we know, we want to notice what's going on within our body at all times. Mindfulness is a learned method of not allowing the mind to attach to the future, not attach to the past, to make sure that we are always bringing ourselves fully cognizant of the current moment. So that's what, and what does it mean for me? Or what does it mean to me? The biggest challenge I see within the corporate world is that people have great difficulties focusing. And now more than ever with COVID-19 and people working from home, they've got various distractions. You know, the children running around the background, pets running around the background. You've got a wife or a husband who's making various noises. You hear the daily sounds, kitchen sounds, you know, cleaning up and all this stuff. Very difficult to fully focus on what people are doing. Mindfulness allows us to bring that focus to exactly what we're doing, to open our minds up to creativity, to quiet, to dispel lack of confidence within us. Allows us to see creative solutions to problems. Allows us to reconnect also with the joy of what we're doing. And so many people, and this is the last thing I'll leave you with, is very few of us really have had the pleasure of doing the job, our ideal job, the job that we think that we always wanted to do. Many people feel that they're stuck doing jobs that they have to do because it makes money for them. This probably represents the majority of the workforce. It doesn't mean that you have to be unhappy doing your job. Doing anything, we can find pleasure within it. And we just have to reconnect with the pleasurable things of doing those jobs. So mindfulness allows you to do that, to rediscover or discover for the first time the joy in the things that we do. Because even if we're doing the job that we absolutely, truly hate doing, there must certainly be some aspect of it that we do enjoy. So we can rediscover that and discover a new love while we're at it. We can embrace getting up on a daily basis and feeling good about what we're doing. Something to be said about, you know, working a hard day and getting compensated for producing good stuff, good quality stuff, whatever it might be. I hope you find this, all this information useful at some different levels. I think there's all kinds of blogs that you can extract from there. If you insight into what I've recorded here and can think about any new blog ideas that apply to the corporate world, please, by all means, feel free to propose those. There is one last thing I want to leave with you, and I want to impress this upon you. It is very important that we continuously mention in all the blogs and really promote and brand the name Meditation House, and that we promote and brand Dan Globus. Absolutely essential. I want my name out there in the world so that when corporations say, you know, we need someone to talk, give a lecture about meditation mindfulness, how it's being used in the workplace, the advantages of it, I want my name to come up with all the other big names. I may not have been teaching as many years as some of these other well-known names. I mean, the better-known names have been teaching for 20, 30, and 40 years. But I do think I have a different approach. I think I am finding a way, or I found a way, to bridge that spiritual gap and the business world. And my approach, my classes, I know as a fact, are very different. So maybe that's a blog for another time. What differentiates Meditation House from all other companies? Why is Dan Globus's meditation style different from the mindfulness that is taught within other corporations? So with that being said, I am off to take my doggy for his Sunday morning walk. Have a wonderful day. Thank you very much for listening to this.